This is another in an irregular series of post-retirement podcasts from your humble host, Peter B. Collins. I'm recording today on Friday, February 19th, 2 days after the announcement of the death of right-wing, bombastic, hate radio host, Rush Limbaugh. And first, I want to explain that I have been fighting a bacterial pneumonia. I think I'm about three-quarters of the way through the course of this, but my voice is a little bit ragged, and I will maybe need to cough a few times, and I'll try to edit those out for you along the way here. So I begin by saying that I don't hate Rush Limbaugh. I hate what he did. I don't celebrate his death, but I do feel a true sense of relief that a man who became a scourge, first on radio, and then in a manner that spread and led to the creation of Fox News, spawned the offspring of Rush Limbaugh, the many other right-wing talk shows that proliferate to this day, a poisoning of American political discourse, the knee-jerk use of name-calling, and flat-out lying about people who simply disagree with a conservative point of view. We have to acknowledge that Rush Limbaugh created the pathway for Donald Trump's politics, the manner in which he campaigned, very much from the Limbaugh playbook. So I'm going to comment on these things over the course of this podcast, and before the end of it, I'll be joined by my friend and colleague, Professor Peter Laufer, who wrote the book Inside Talk Radio, and Peter has hosted radio talk shows in the U.S. and abroad. He has worked as a journalist. He's published more than 20 books, and I will look forward to bringing you his comments. And as I look at what I know about Rush Limbaugh and his rise, his dominance of the AM radio frequencies across the country for almost 30 years, and the tone and content of his daily program, one of the things that is completely missing from the obituaries and the histories, even those that are, so glowing in their praise of Rush Limbaugh, they don't really give an accurate description of how he came to be selected. And so that's where I want to open today. And it takes us back to the 1980s. AM radio was being beaten by FM music stations. The age of the audience was going upward, and the ratings and revenues were going downward. And Ed McLaughlin, who to his credit had been the general manager of KGO here in San Francisco when it adopted a news talk format back in the 1960s, he had risen to become the president of the ABC Radio Networks, and he had many accomplishments in that job. But during the 1980s, he conducted sophisticated market research across the country. And it was all for the launch of a talk radio service, I believe it's called ABC Talk Radio. And they did, in fact, roll it out. It only was adopted by about 50 radio stations across the country. I recall the lineup included a San Francisco veteran named Owen Spann, and also a young ophthalmologist named Dr. Dean Adell. And Dean Adell was the first spinoff from the ABC Talk Radio failure. Ed McLaughlin formed his own company, EFM, and he syndicated Dean Adell. But I mentioned the research that he conducted for ABC Talk Radio. And one of the findings of that research was that there was a big opening, an opportunity for a controversial, outrageous, self-referential, self-reverential host. And the awkward terminology that came out of the research was non-guested confrontation talk radio. Let's take that apart. Non-guested. That means the show is a monologue. And for a monologue to be interesting, you have to be topical, you have to be interesting, and it helps if you're funny. And I don't take credit away from the skills of Rush Limbaugh as a broadcaster. He was very good at it. It was the insidious message that he wrapped up in his package that I don't like, that I flatly detest it. So, non-guested, confrontation. Well, how do you confront somebody if they're not there? Well, Limbaugh would cherry-pick sound bites of whoever it was, Jesse Jackson, Ted Kennedy, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, on forward into the new century. It was Barack Obama and many of the figures who are still on the scene today. None of the people who were routinely and viciously attacked by Rush Limbaugh were ever able to defend themselves, to talk back on his own show. And this became really a hallmark of talk radio, as what had been, you know, a broad general discussion platform for people typically hosted by a local individual in the community who knew the political figures, knew the issues of that city, and who would provide a forum for both sides, all sides, to discuss the topics at hand. And Limbaugh changed that whole framework because the show was all about him. The fundamental premise was that conservatism was not just right as in the political spectrum, but that it was right, it was righteous, it was correct. That anything that challenged that was idiotic, un-American, dangerous, and subject to his great skills of ridicule. And so I printed out from Limbaugh's website the tribute that he gave on air to Ed McLaughlin when Mr. McLaughlin died a few years ago. And he does appropriately give McLaughlin credit for creating the pathway for Rush to deliver his act. It was an act. He admitted that to me. And he also greased the way for radio stations that had formerly operated under the Fairness Doctrine, where multiple points of view would be presented, and changed it into this, you know, when I first heard Limbaugh, and I told him directly, I said, "You sound like a preacher feature." And in the archived interview that I'm also releasing today, it's about half an hour long, and it's edited down from a one-hour guest appearance that Limbaugh made on my local radio show on KNBR in San Francisco. And he's at turns, you know, self-congratulatory and full of himself, narcissistic, with tinges of humility. And also, he, you know, to his credit, didn't talk down to me. He treated me as a peer. And I respect him for that. I think I gave him a pretty good run for the money under the circumstances that I described to you at the beginning of that archived interview. And so when Limbaugh talks about his origins, he was hosting a show in Sacramento. He'd been there about 4 years. He had decent ratings. But he wasn't doing the total Rush act that he rolled out when he went into national syndication. Ed McLaughlin heard his presentation in Sacramento, and he invited Rush to come over to San Francisco and meet with him at the Hotel Nico. That story has a few variations to it. And for about 6 months, McLaughlin groomed Rush Limbaugh, moved him to New York, and because of the power and influence that McLaughlin had at ABC Radio, he created an opportunity, an opening, to put Limbaugh on there locally for a couple of hours each day. And that gave him the major market reach that made it a profitable proposition with the 50 mostly medium and small market stations that were left over from the failed ABC Talk Radio project. So this was shock radio for conservatives. It was intentionally devised, engineered for that purpose. McLaughlin, who had worked with many radio talents over the years, was convinced that an outrageous personality who would be given license to say the hateful things that many people, particularly less educated, less sophisticated people, think but are afraid to say. And here's the guy who blurts them out. But we had a history of TV shows like Morton Downey Jr., Joe Pyne. And there were some outrageous hosts who were operating on local stations across the country. And so Ed McLaughlin is the real Dr. Evil, if you will, who created the Rush Limbaugh monster. So I joined KNBR as the midday host in late 1989. And initially, I was teamed up with Michael Knight, a very talented man who I had worked with at other radio stations in the 1980s. And I'll just tell you briefly that management selected me over Michael Knight and brutally dispatched him after about a month of our duet on afternoon radio. And that's an episode that was very painful for me. So we were doing a kind of general talk format. My instructions were to have a guest on for no longer than half an hour, to change the topic, keep it moving. They liked breezier topics over hard-hitting politics. But it became clear that I'm a liberal. And so when they decided to add Rush Limbaugh in the fall of 1990, I was the liberal counterbalance, in the view of management, that would ease the controversy that they expected by putting an anti-gay, anti-woman, anti-black host on in uber-liberal San Francisco. And at a staff meeting where they announced that they were doing a shuffle, and a mid-morning host, Leo Laporte, was the odd man out. Leo's gone on to do a tech show and very successful. He's a guy I really respect. But radio, there's only so much time in the day, and for somebody to be hired, somebody has to exit. So they played this, we call them air checks, a demo tape of Rush Limbaugh. And we all just cringed. Consider that these are all adults. Many of the people at KNBR had been working in the business for 20 to 30 years. And we were schooled by the old rules of fairness, self-restraint, trying to maintain a modicum of good taste, and respect for a broad spectrum of listeners. And in the 3 to 5 minutes of this air check of Limbaugh, all of those were just chucked out the window. I recall vividly that one of the elements we heard was one of his ugly homeless updates. And if you recall, during the 1980s, Ed Meese, who was Reagan's right-hand man and was his attorney general for a period, he said homelessness doesn't exist. It's just anecdotal. But Limbaugh, aiming for middle America, trying to drive a wedge between conservatives and progressives, people with a heart, who said, well, you know, homeless people, they deserve our attention. In the wealthiest nation on earth, we can peel off a few bucks to try to help those who are not just down on their luck, but may have had a lifetime of setbacks. And of course, many of the homeless people were Vietnam vets with PTSD and with other serious problems expressed through alcohol and drug use and a desire to separate from mainstream society. And so hearing that as a setup, that here comes this loudmouth, self-promoting guy who claims he's always right, talent on loan from God, and he's putting down and punching down the people who can least defend themselves. So it's a kind of rollerball wrestling, you know, model that is intended to make the listener feel superior to the people who are being ridiculed by the host. So they added Limbaugh's show to the lineup. I recall on the second day, I was walking past program director Bob Agnew's office, and he waved me in. Rush Limbaugh was on the phone, checking in to see if there had been any riots or protests in the streets of San Francisco because his show was on KNBR. And I talked to him briefly, and he seemed puzzled when I described his show as a preacher feature. But he, you know, kind of took it in stride, and I didn't talk to him very long that day. But that was my first encounter. And by the way, in an article prompted by Limbaugh's death in the San Francisco Chronicle, former KGO program operations manager Jack Swanson said that he had been offered the first rights to carry the Limbaugh show on KGO. But he passed, saying that he thought his conservative approach wouldn't fly in San Francisco. And Jack was wrong about that. Part of it has to do with the distribution of the population here. Most people focus in on the city of San Francisco and its liberal, progressive, socialist, whatever you want to call them, politicians. And it is a left-wing political city. But it's not the largest population center in the region. And these two AM stations, KNBR and KGO, had big signals that reached well beyond the city limits of San Francisco. It's a pretty small 49-square-mile area. The big population is in the suburbs and in Santa Clara County, Silicon Valley, San Jose. And when you look at the voter trends, the polling in those areas, you can see that they are distinctly more conservative than the city of San Francisco's population. So that was the calculation, was to basically write off a handful of white liberals and embrace a larger population of people who were in the political closet, who didn't discuss their politics because it wasn't perceived as popular. And so when Limbaugh came on and attacked women as feminazis, attacked environmentalists as tree huggers who were dangerous to the American economy, attacked liberals as evil, there were many people who took delight in his whole shtick. So it was interesting to be on the radio every day after Limbaugh did his act for 3 hours. Here comes Peter B., the local guy. And I would present a very different point of view on the final days of the Bush administration, the first Gulf War, the early days of the Clinton administration, Hillary's attempt to reform health care, California politics. And the ditto heads would dominate the switchboard. So when I would take listener calls, I would hear from people who had been programmed, some might say brainwashed, by 3 hours of Limbaugh indoctrination. So I want to turn to the interview that I have released as a separate podcast today. And I know some of my listeners and some new listeners who will pick up this podcast are going to say, look, I can't stand even the thought of listening to a half hour of this blowhard, this gas bag. So if you'll indulge me, I have a couple of clips, sound bites, from that interview, totaling, less than 4 minutes. And I'd like to play these and comment on the interchange that I had with Limbaugh on that day in September of 1991.
I look at my show as an entertainment forum for people, and I screen calls to find the best call. You know what the main, in my philosophy, you know what the purpose of a good call is on my show? It's to make me look good. I will tell you flat out, this show is not about what anybody else but me thinks. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to discover what America thinks because it's impossible. There's no talk show host in the world who can tell you what his community or his neighborhood thinks based on what happens on his show. And so I'm not even laboring under that misconception. Calls are there to make me look good, to bring up interesting things. There's no public service aspect. There's no First Amendment aspect that I care about regarding it. And we're not looking for people who agree. In fact, we strive for people who disagree.
We'll talk more about that as we continue.
So part of, as I mentioned, because we had so many commercials and all the other stuff, we had to compress our conversation. And I, for example, wasn't able to follow up on that. He claims that he allowed oppositional callers on his show. That was only true in the case of inarticulate people who were perceived as African American. I heard repeatedly there was this woman from Detroit, and he'd put her on the air and then go into a diatribe about Ebonics and, you know, various attacks on black culture. And he didn't take that many phone calls to begin with. But the ditto heads would salute him at the outset, so he knew that he was not facing any kind of a confrontational call. And as soon as they had slavishly, expressed their loyalty to him and served up some kind of a softball, the caller would be faded out. Now, let me be clear. Every radio talk show host does that. You don't let a caller take over the show. And when you listen to the archived interview, there's a guy who calls in and he basically says dittos to Rush and then attacks me for supporting the right of individuals, which was affirmed by the Supreme Court, to burn the American flag. And that was classic Limbaugh dittohead style. Those were the kinds of callers who I would routinely face on my own show in the afternoon. One of the things that came up in the interview as well, that he referenced in the clip you just heard, that it's all about entertainment. And that was the convenient dodge. Whenever Limbaugh went too far, too controversial, too hateful, too racist, it's just a joke. I'm just entertaining people. But the bluster that he employed, the total control over the show, and the way that he would skewer his political opponents while ignoring the defects and liabilities of the people who he supported. Here's another clip from that interview with Limbaugh in 1991.
Why don't you, a caller mentioned this to you one time, make fun of John Sununu, Dan Quayle, Ronald Reagan is a guy who, even if you love him, is a caricature who can be the source of humor. Why do you stay away from those people and simply drive piles into Ted Kennedy?
Well, please don't try to make a moral equivalence here between Kennedy and Reagan or Kennedy and Quayle.
They're public figures. You're a funny guy.
But why
do you only find humor in the icons of the left?
Well, in all honesty here, it's because I love Reagan, and I very much appreciate what he stood for. And I am sick and tired of the ceaseless ending character assassination and malignment that this man has received. And I don't need to add to it. I need to defend it. People say that what I do is attack my targets. And I don't do that, Peter. I get up and read the newspaper like everybody else, and I looked at who is attacking somebody. The militant environmentalists are trying to attack the timber industry. Militant vegetarians are attacking the beef industry. So I simply respond. I defend.
Mm-hmm. But often in responding to the militants, you write off an entire movement. Here's a letter from a guy in Stockton, and I won't go into all the details, but essentially he says, well, hey, you quit smoking. You recognize that you were hurting your own personal environment, but you write off even moderate people who want to save the planet, who want to use conservation.
I've been very clear about this. The people with whom I have a disagreement are the extremists who wish to damage the capitalistic system of this country in order to see their remedies implemented. I am not at all for dirty water or dirty air. I'm not at all for not caring about it. But I do not think that you need to shut down the U.S. economy or start closing businesses or losing people, having people lose jobs in order to fix the environment. I don't think we're in doomsday. I don't think it's a crisis. I don't think it's fragilely balanced. And I think that capitalism and freedom and the American way of life are the solution to the messes that we humans make, not the solution being going back to the horse and buggy days and stop driving our automobiles and so forth.
Okay, got your point. Let's go.
So, right there, he even mischaracterizes the extremists as he sees them. And he makes it this pitched battle where there's no room for compromise, where these people are threatening the capitalist system. And let's be fair. Since Limbaugh went on the air, the capitalist system has run amok, unregulated, unfettered. It's one of the reasons a guy like him could make $80 million a year as a talk show host. And the obscene wealth that has been acquired and augmented by the wealthiest in this country is something that he sees as a good thing. And so his whole worldview is corrupt. But he presents it as accurate and righteous. I want to mention that there is an industry publication, a rag, called Talkers Magazine. And they promoted Rush and all of his clones, Hannity and these other people who have risen over the years. And there's a 20-minute video, and I don't know how much of it you can handle, because it is pure hagiography. Sets up Rush as this legendary radio talent who rescued the AM radio industry, and there's some truth to that. I'll include a link to the Talkers video in the show file for this podcast. Now, one of the issues that I want to describe related to Rush Limbaugh is his addiction to OxyContin. And like any other human being, I have a lot of compassion for people who become addicted to painkillers. In his case, it was so extreme. The information became public about the amount of opioids he was using every day while he did a talk show. And he was exposed for using friends and other third parties who worked for him to acquire massive amounts. He was exposed for doctor shopping so he could get multiple prescriptions to maintain his... I mean, it's amazing that it didn't kill him. And as a result, he took a little time off, went to rehab, and he lost his hearing in both ears. And he could afford to have cochlear implants. If you've seen pictures of him, especially the one where Melania gives him the Presidential Medal of Freedom, he had these big, bulging electrodes implanted on the side of his skull. And I don't know what level of hearing that restored. When he was in the radio studio and taking calls from listeners, they used a device that shifted voice to text. And he was actually reading what the caller was saying. And so I don't have any animus for Limbaugh related to his addiction. It's that he never used it to try to help other people. Now, I can't say that I listened to every hour of every broadcast of his show. At most, I checked in for 10 or 15 minutes a day. But I never, ever, ever heard him or read reporting about him even discussing his bout of addiction with opioids. And when you consider how many of his listeners are part of those who became addicted, in some cases shifted to heroin when their prescriptions ran out, the abominable total of deaths of mostly white Americans, likely listeners to the Rush Limbaugh show, and his failure to address that in any way that I'm aware of is something that I think damns him. Now, in a minute, I want to talk about the broader impact of Limbaugh on American politics. And I'm going to pass. I did create some notes here on all the ugly comments that he made over the years. But as I'm talking about it now, I don't see a lot of value in repeating his hateful, often ignorant commentary, especially the racist stuff. You can find that elsewhere, and you're probably well aware of it and sick of it. But what I do want to talk about is that Rush Limbaugh, as a phenomenon, as a syndicated radio host, as a man who commanded an audience of 15 million or so every day, this never would have happened without the complicity of the executives of the radio industry in the United States. They made the decision, like my bosses, Tony Salvador and Bob Agnew, did, to look past the pain that Limbaugh inflicted, to call it humor, entertainment. They were cheering on the political messaging that he provided, the tilt of America farther and farther to the right with each year of Limbaugh's ascendance in the media, and they profited from it. As I mentioned, these AM stations had become dinosaurs. They were expensive to operate. They had become reliant on very high profit margins that were not achievable as the audience aged and declined in numbers. And they made decisions similar to a pornographer. And let me tell you that I've actually met and interviewed Larry Flint, who died recently, the Hustler publisher. I met Bob Guccione, the publisher of Penthouse. And I compare the decisions of pornographers to the decisions of radio management to listen to this product that attracted an audience, generated ratings that were converted into revenues, that hit the bottom line and made profits. They knew what he was doing every day. They knew he was bullshitting. He was lying. He was misleading people. And he was directing the American body politic in at least what many of them knew in their hearts to be a very dangerous direction. And so, as we take a critical look at the Limbaugh phenomenon, we cannot separate it from the people who enabled him, the people who promoted him, and the people who profited on what he did. And as you may know, I was part of the effort during the Bush administration, it started in 2004, to try to retake some of the broadcast spectrum for non-conservative voices, liberals, progressives, even moderates. We'd all been squeezed out, and many jobs were lost. At least 600, right? That's the number of radio stations that picked up the Limbaugh show, and in most cases, they had a local host who was being paid a decent wage to host a radio show. And I'll be candid with you that my own career in radio was ruined. There were times when I thought, well, maybe I should load up on OxyContin and see if I could fake being a conservative the way Rush Limbaugh faked his role on a daily basis. I never actually tried it. But what I did try was investing in a radio station in Monterey, California. My partner, Hal Ginsberg, provided most of the cash. We aired some of the programs from Air America. They tried to force us to take Al Franken in every show that they offered, and we didn't do that. I launched my own syndicated show from KRXA, and many of the people who are listening to this podcast today heard me in their local city. We were on in 20 or 25 markets at our peak. I was also an early host on Sirius Satellite Radio, 2004-2005. And it didn't work because Air America was just a huge failure. It led Al Franken to get elected to the Senate, and it led Rachel Maddow to her perch at MSNBC. Mark Maron is a comic and podcaster who some of you know. Sam Cedar was on Air America. But by and large, it didn't have an impact. And I have written a piece about that that I'll link to in the show file for this podcast. I published it in 2013 at truthout.org. And my syndicated business lost over $150,000. Hal Ginsberg lost much more at KRXA. Norman Goldman, who came out of the Ed Schultz zone, he reported that he lost $3 million trying to maintain his progressive radio show. But management would not allow us on the air on the same stations that carried Rush Limbaugh. We were relegated to weaker signals on higher frequencies. We didn't have the money for promotion to make people aware that we existed. And so Rush Limbaugh fundamentally changed talk radio into right-wing radical hate radio. And that brought us Michael Savage, Sean Hannity, local cowboys like Bill Cunningham in Cincinnati, Dan Bongino, Tommy Lauren, Lars Larson, Eric Erickson. Their voices dominate on AM radio, and you may not know that because you've stopped listening. This, of course, led to the rise of Fox News. It's no accident that Roger Ailes worked with Rush Limbaugh on a TV show that failed. But it gave him the, you know, the seeds of the idea, and he got Rupert Murdoch to fund Fox News. That, in turn, has spawned One America News, Newsmax, the Sinclair broadcast group on local stations across the country. And I don't expect it anytime soon. But the corrective we need here is real regulation. Bill Clinton's 1996 deregulation of the radio industry caused the whole problem to metastasize. And we have never had any regulation of cable television, including the cable news channels. They don't operate under the Federal Communications Commission. That is a grotesque error, but I don't believe there is the political will to correct it. My final comment before we're joined by Professor Peter Laufer is that there is a direct arc from Rush Limbaugh to Donald Trump. The very toolbox, if you will, that Limbaugh used was embraced and utilized skillfully, effectively, by Trump. And his symbiosis with Limbaugh, Ted Cruz was Rush's first choice in 2016, but Rush is no fool. When he saw the freight train coming, he hopped on board. He was an early enabler of Trump once Ted Cruz was out of the race. And along the way, he legitimized and facilitated the anti-immigrant attitudes, building the wall, the trade war against the Chi-Coms, one of the most foolish things that Trump did in response to some legitimate inequities. And into 2020, even as he was only on the air 2 or 3 days a week, as he was treated for his cancer that became terminal, Limbaugh supported Trump, who ran on no platform, offered no vision of what a second term would look like. He simply attacked the other side, relentlessly, with his silly nicknames. He used his political mob rallies, modeled on the Limbaugh show. Totally in control, no conflicting views allowed. Nobody who didn't slavishly agree with Trump would show up for a rally like that. It's all part of the Limbaugh model. And so I guess I am crediting Rush Limbaugh, but only with the dysfunction, the division, and the war on the truth. Because Limbaugh and later Trump learned that they could say whatever they said, they wanted to say, and a certain subset of people would believe it. And if they said it over and over again, even more people would believe it. And ultimately, they created the right-wing silo that produced the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. They were there to hunt down the Rataclibs, to own them, to silence them. And some of them wanted to kill them. All of this has its roots in Rush Limbaugh. Joining me now is Professor Peter Laufer, a professor of journalism at the University of Oregon in Eugene, a prolific journalist and author, more than 20 books to his credit. Most recently, I interviewed him about his latest book called Up Against the Wall, about U.S. immigration policy. He's also the author of a 1995 book called Inside Talk Radio. And Peter has practiced talk radio going back to the 1970s. He has worked as a program director at a major station in Washington, D.C., as a consultant in Europe. And he has a lot to say about the impact.
You know, it's really easy for you to say all of that, Peter, coming from the point of view that you do, your self-aggrandizing attempt to make yourself seem like you know something about talk radio, when the rest of us out here doing the work know that it's people like you who are wrecking radio for the rest of us, making it impossible for us to be able to just sit down with our families the way we used to back in the old days, with the Philco on top of the refrigerator and Jack Benny telling us those kinds of jokes that today would not get on the radio because they're not dirty.
Nicely done, Peter. And the irony that you're serving up there is really a good example of the act that Rush Limbaugh presented, which was to pit conservative Americans who he kind of inherited the role of speaking for from Paul Harvey, who was on the air for many years before him. But he amped it up with a lot of insults and invective, with produced attacks on specific groups like homeless and homosexuals and women. And he created this whole mentality that has divided America and that has demonized those who are not conservatives as anti-American, people who hate America and want to destroy it. And it really is a remarkable arc that his work has contributed.
There's no question. And contributed is the word. We do not want to give him, as skillful a radio producer as he was, too much credit. And I think we also need to be careful about the word conservative, because you and I, we know each other, we're friends and colleagues, Peter. I think that we both respect, and you know, that's another Limbaugh, and it's not just Limbaugh, another rhetorical trick that Limbaugh uses. You and I both agree, Peter. Well, what a bunch of garbage that is. I'm supposed to be speaking for you, but Limbaugh did that consistently, speaking for his audience, and his audience too often, unfortunately, was an audience unskilled in compromise and nuance, and so would be happy to have somebody saying, you and I both agree that. And that, combined with the hate mongering, really is the evil personified by Rush Limbaugh and taken up by so many Limbaugh wannabes. But I interrupted myself, as something that we do in talk radio.
Yes.
During the churn, when we're throwing out all kinds of things to try to get the phones to ring. Because remember, talk radio is first and foremost a business. That's why Limbaugh made the reported $85 million a year. But what I was trying to say before I kept interrupting myself so skillfully was I think we have to be careful about the word conservative, because what Limbaugh was a hate-mongering businessman in the Limbaugh business who took advantage of a political point of view and polluted it, poisoned it.
Well, and when I interviewed him in 1991, and I've shared that interview from the archives as a separate podcast today, during the lengthy commercial breaks, and by the way, when I edited out all the other stuff, we only got to speak for 34 minutes in a full hour show. At any rate, during the breaks, Limbaugh conceded to me that it was an act and that he, you know, exaggerated himself, the bombast, the self-aggrandizement, the narcissism, and all the, you know, extreme language that he used to talk about himself, talent on loan from God, error-free 100%, that all of that was just showbiz. And his comment to me was, Peter, I'm going to ride this thing as far as I can.
And there's nothing at all wrong with show business. You and I both practice it, Peter. But when that show business then is filled with invective, when the potency of the medium is used to lie, to speak lies to the powerless instead of truth to power, to instead of afflicting the comfortable and comforting the afflicted, instead lie to the afflicted, to sow hate and cast blame, and day after day beating on people who are suffering and making other people, the listeners, think that the suffering people are the ones that are creating problems for the listeners. This is evil personified, 50,000 watts at the station where you worked when you talked to him, across the country, thousands of radio stations. And it's an example of a societal ill that lives on even with Limbaugh's death.
And one of his real skills was to trivialize, mischaracterize, and then caricature the viewpoints and the philosophies that conflicted with his free market capitalism, deregulation, and the other tenets of Reaganism.
Yeah, no question about it. And at the same time, while it was wrapped up in politics, it was personal opportunism. And at that same time, when you talked to him on the radio, Peter, the San Francisco Examiner media critic at the time, David Armstrong, talked to him. And Limbaugh said to him exactly what you just said. In other words, you know, some people say you guys in broadcasting have a public trust. This is Limbaugh speaking. Bull, we are a business. We are in the entertainment business. Radio is an emotional medium. If we get you pounding on the dashboard, we've done our job. That's the guy on the radio. The guy behind the scenes, the managers, were personified, I believe, when they would forget their own politics or good taste and put Limbaugh on the air, by the general manager of a station in Sonoma County, California, who told me when I was researching the book, I would put anything on the air as long as it made me money. And Peter, you and I both know a Limbaugh wannabe. We worked with him in Washington, D.C. at WRC, Brian Wilson. And when I first became program and news director at WRC in Washington, I inherited him. And I was questioning him about his Limbaugh-like act. And he looked at me and he said, I don't care. You can put me in the white hat or put me in the black hat. It doesn't matter to me. That was his mentality. And I maintain the mentality of Limbaugh and those like him today that live on and are on the radio.
And I'm still a little bitter because you put me in the studio with him one day as he revealed that he was packing a pistol in his briefcase.
Yeah, well, I was testing you, Peter.
Yeah. But I want to return to this responsibility of the broadcasters, because Limbaugh would have just been talking into empty space if it weren't for the 600 stations that carried his show. And building on what you quoted from Terry DeVoto, I liken the decision-making process to that of a pornographer. And that is, what can I put on the cover of my Skin magazine that will sell the most copies? And, you know, which fetish or, you know, particular erotic fantasy do I need to exploit this month to outdo what I did last month? And Peter, you and I once met with Bob Guccione, the owner and publisher of Penthouse. I've interviewed the recently departed Larry Flint of Hustler magazine fame. And I really do believe that many of the decision makers who put Rush Limbaugh on the air had the same thought process. I don't care. I know he's a liar. I know he is damaging our political values and only selling one side of the story. But my bottom line is fat, and that's what matters.
And we saw that all across the country, on through to today. When I was going to the grocery store today, I was listening to KPNW here in Eugene, Oregon, and they were lamenting Limbaugh's demise and talking proudly about how they were one of the first radio stations in the country to pick up the show when it became nationally syndicated, when it escaped from the confines of its origin in Sacramento. And that kind of capitalism, but really what it is greed, that kind of amoral greed, to decide that you are going to take this, whether you want to call it a public trust or your good luck, but this powerful entity, a radio station that enjoys a de facto credibility because of this voice of God that comes out of the speaker and is purportedly truth-telling. You want to take this and use it just to make money and not care one whit about the fact that you are taking advantage of people who are unskilled in listening. They're unskilled in analyzation, in nuance and compromise. And I know that might sound arrogant coming from a university professor, but that's the reality of so much of that audience. Sure, some people listen because they found it entertaining, others because they found it abhorrent and it was like watching a car wreck when some people can't look away from the misery of the wreck. But lacking the critical thinking skills made it possible for Limbaugh to be able to amass this audience that, no matter what you may think otherwise, was influential in electing what you could call the mega Limbaugh, Donald Trump, to the White House.
I want to come back to Trump in a moment, but it's quite interesting that you mentioned KPNW, because that station is owned by Bicoastal Media. That company is a majority owned by a guy we both know and have worked for, Ken Dennis. And I remember back in 2004, when I was doing the satellite radio show that Ken was producing out of San Francisco, and he was proudly telling us how he was a max donor to the John Kerry campaign and, you know, very, very progressive in his own values. Well, I was recently alerted and I confirmed that KPNW continues to run the Alex Jones radio show. Now, I don't believe in censorship, but Alex Jones crosses the line into incitement. He knowingly promotes falsehoods, and he was one of the key organizers of the Trump rabble for the rally that led to the attack in Washington on the Capitol on January 6th. And I just consider it fundamentally wrong to continue to feature a voice like his when it's very clear he is beyond the pale.
Yeah, and even those who walk the line a little more carefully, like Lars Larson,
yeah.
who is a local variant of Rush Limbaugh and broadcasts across the Pacific Northwest, including KPNW, rants and raves about the stolen election and the arrogance, again, the greed of building an audience based on lies, based on hate mongering, is overwhelmingly depressing for those of us who love radio and love the finer points and fun of talk radio in particular. Watching it be manipulated into this sordid, counterproductive, divisive act has been what watching Rush Limbaugh's career arc is all about.
And Peter, returning to your point about Donald Trump, he really did use many of the tools in the Limbaugh toolbox, and it was very clear in what I repeatedly refer to as his mob rallies that he used the same techniques to play the victim role and then attack those who are not present and unable to muster a defense, much less a counter argument. And Trump really skillfully used these, starting in 2015, to mount his campaign, and it became, like the pornographer, increasingly difficult for him to outdo the lie that he told yesterday. And it reaches the point where it is not trivial. It's not something that can be tossed away with a laugh. It has very serious and dangerous implications.
And let's not give all the credit to Rush Limbaugh. Let's remember that he learned from the playbook of Goebbels in Germany and from Father Coughlin. And these other demagogues that came before him, he just very cleverly tapped into the availability of AM radio and the power of radio at a time when radio was flailing about looking for somebody, something to make it money. And it was, to use the cliche now, a perfect storm that resulted in part in this divisiveness that's based on lies and hate and an enemy that is a straw man or woman, because there's never somebody there to create a counter point of view. It's one point of view. What you and I both know by this strange term, which is non-guested confrontational. So if those listening to your program here today, Peter, think about a Limbaugh-like program, no matter what one it is. There rarely are guests, and there's always somebody who's seemingly on the other side of the table as a debate partner, and that debate partner never gets to talk. That debate partner is the other. That debate partner is the enemy. That debate partner is the cause of all of you in the audience, all of your problems. And I, the host, am here to tell you why that's your problem. And I know the solution for you, which is to think just like I think and do just as I do.
Yeah, very important points there. Peter, as we look at this and the negative legacy of Limbaugh, the linkage, you know, Roger Ailes produced his TV show, which was a failure, but he then got Rupert Murdoch to bankroll Fox News, and we know the insidious impact that it has had. And we now find ourselves in this, kind of post-precipice position where how do we recover? And, fundamentally, I point out that cable news continues to be totally unregulated. There are no government standards to in any way influence the way, and MSNBC is not as bad as Fox, but they use the same tactics. And I believe that while the fairness doctrine that was eliminated under Reagan was cumbersome, that the principles that you must enable a range of perspectives, a range of voices to weigh in if you are going to be granted a mass media facility, whether it's because you bought it or because you have a license to operate it. And because the both the public spectrum and the public debate die when it is one-sided and controlled and manipulated, I really think we do need some form of regulation that provides for real balance and for access by all rational and reasonable parties to public debate facilities.
Yeah, but the problem with that, Peter, as you know, is that the rationale for something like the Fairness Doctrine was limited bandwidth. And we do now have unlimited bandwidth. And then further, you use the term rational. And so what's rational for some is irrational for others.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with you in principle, but I think that the way to get there, especially given where we are now, really the onus falls on all the rest of us, not the operators, not the owners, but all the rest of us, and that we need, and this is tough, tough work, but we need to learn to speak across this divide that's been created. We need to find commonality with our neighbors. We may disagree with them about something, say politics, but we can agree with them about apple pie and swap recipes or whatever it takes, step by step, to figure out how to again, and even made more difficult by the pandemic because we can't hang out at the bar or the cafe, but figure out ways where we can find a common denominator so that we can begin to have conversations rather than be dictated to by demagogues like Limbaugh or be taught by demagogues like Limbaugh not to be open to listen to opinions other than our own, to what we teach at the university, and it's no ivory tower lesson, and it's nothing a feat. Just constructive, creative, open thinking about issues so that we can appreciate that somebody thinks something different than we think, and yet that doesn't make them evil and does not make them somebody that we want to target with hate and that we want to eliminate from our lives. We need to find that commonality via critical thinking and critical action.
Professor Peter Laufer from the University of Oregon at Eugene, thanks for joining me today, and thank you for your commentary.
Always a pleasure to talk with you, Peter. And about now, it's time for me to hang up the phone and tell you you're wrong and you should just shut up.
Well, before I go, I want to share a brief clip. It's a voicemail that was left by a listener on my line at KNBR back in the 1990s. And I found this as I was digging up the archived interview with Limbaugh that I'm posting as a separate podcast. And I think it's self-explanatory.
Yes, Peter B., I have a sad story to relate to you. In November of 1990, I tested positive for EIB. But I found that with a good, healthy dose of realism in the Peter B. Collins Show, I was able to get over it. And I think others out there can get over it, too.
Okay. I don't know his name, but I am grateful for that little comment. Thank you for listening today, and I will be podcasting on an irregular schedule as time and other factors permit. Thank you for listening, and I hope you will share this podcast to anyone you think should hear it. And if you have comments, you can direct them to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.